Good morning. Thank you, dear friends, for making the effort to join us at the update on the IRS 2011 Voluntary Disclosure Initiative. We have an esteemed panel of 8 professionals, attorneys, and CPAs. In your folder, you will find their biographies. In particular, I would like to thank our sponsors, Colara LLP, a law firm in downtown Boston, and Conlett Winrenza CPAs in Providence, Rhode Island, and Waltham, Massachusetts. And of course, our firm, Law Offices of M. Robinson & Company in Boston. I would like to call your attention in your study booklets to an orange piece of paper, which is a speaker evaluation form. Please fill it out at the end of the program and return it to Tamar Grin Vogel, Marketing and Events Coordinator of M. Robinson & Company, who is sitting outside and now just stood up, and or Donna Longo-Cumes, Business Development Director of Colara LLP, in the black sweater in the back. My name is Debbie Robinson. I'm Director of Marketing of M. Robinson & Company. You will also find here a question sheet. Perhaps you have a specific inquiry that was one of the reasons that you came, and your question can be presented to the speakers. There are some other free gifts here for you. This one is this week's issue of the Boston Business Journal. Their office is in our building, and they are happy to share free issue. If you open it up on page 3, there is a piece of paper created by Margaret Ray, one of the circulation managers, with a special offer for a lower price subscription, including 4 weeks free. If you are interested in signing up today, you can give your paper to Yechiel Robinson, paralegal at M. Robinson & Company, who will bring it in. Otherwise, enjoy your newspaper. Consider it later. Our event today is listed in the calendar. Many of the events in the Boston Business Journal are free. Also, compliments of the Boston Business Journal is the 2011 Book of Lists. If you have not done so yet, please deposit your business card in the basket at the check-in table so that you can be one of the potential winners of this book. I would also like to introduce David Nahumi, who is one of the technology directors and advisors for M. Robinson & Company, assisted us with our complete office changeover of new computers, but also has skill in video recording and photography. And standing on the side there is David Nahumi, and his business cards are in the back of the room. Before we begin our program, I would like to introduce our colleague, Millie Tobolsky, a CPA, who is the chair of the South Shore Forum of CPAs that runs monthly study clubs, and she will tell you about the next event.
Thank you. I'm down the drain. I forgot my flyers. Anyways, we're having our next meeting Thursday, May 26th. 7:20 a.m. We start exact. 9 a.m. It's a breakfast, buffet breakfast. We're going to have Ernie Almonte from Rhode Island. He was on the AICPA committee, past chair, past audit general of Rhode Island. He's currently chair for the Department of Defense Audit Committee. We meet at Braintree at the Chateau Restaurant. If you're interested, give me your card, we'll send you a flyer. We're always happy to have people. You don't have to pre-register, just come. It's $25 for 2 CPE credits and a full breakfast. Thank you.
Yes, and last, before we begin, I would like to individually introduce our speakers, though they are divided up by panel. First, Morris Robinson, tax attorney CPA from N. Robinson & Company, also my husband. William Levette from Colara LLP in Boston, law firm. Ellen S. Keefe from the law offices of Ellen Keefe in Boston. Gregory Murphy from the law firm of Taylor, Ganson, and Perrin, also in our building at 160 Federal Street. Then Norman LeBlanc, CPA, MST from Conlett Winrenza CPAs, one of our sponsors. and from M. Robinson and Company, Timothy Weeks, LLM, and Matthew Morris, LLM. And finally, Jonathan Lachowitz from White Lighthouse Investment Management, and he's sitting in the back for now. So I will pass the podium on to our panel. There will be a break when you can enjoy more refreshments.
Thank you very much, Debbie, and thank you all for coming. Just one last thank you to our events coordinator, Tamar Grunvogel. A thought about opinions. The opinions of the speakers are theirs. They do not necessarily represent the considered opinions of their firms. And the opinions of the speakers may change over time as they gain new expertise in this area. Before we begin the first panel, I would like to frame the question, is this all for real? Let me say it a little bit another way. Is the 2011 OVDI perhaps the first step in a massive crackdown? On February 8th, the IRS announced this new overseas voluntary disclosure initiative. The IRS quoted Commissioner Shulman, who said that combating international tax evasion is a top priority for IRS. The new disclosure initiative, according to Shulman, is the last best chance for people to get into the system. And I focus on the word system. I believe that the IRS is planning a bit of a crackdown. There's a motivation. Institutional humiliation. Make no mistake about it. The IRS was humiliated by the last go-around. When the IRS announced the first overseas voluntary disclosure program in 2009, in March, they expected perhaps 1,000 people would come forward. Most years, no more than 100 people come forward in the entire year in the normal voluntary disclosure program. They expected 1,000. They got almost 18,000. 15,000 people who qualified and 3,000 who came afterwards. Clearly, the IRS was either unaware that there was massive non-compliance, or they were complacent about it. Either way, they were humiliated. And I would suggest to you that humiliation is a very powerful emotion. It affects people's behavior, and I suspect that it also affects institutions' behavior. If we take a look at the current program, and we compare it to the 2009 program, we see a very important, startling difference. In 2009, the lead time to be accepted into the program, the lead time to receive the benefit of the lower penalties was about 4 days. That's how long it took to put together a 3-page letter and get it sent out to the volunteer coordinator. Today, it takes perhaps 3 to 4 months. Why? Because this is what you have to do. You have to obtain monthly bank statements. It takes time to do it. You have to translate those statements sometimes into English. Once you get statements in English that you can understand, then you have to translate them, translate transactions from foreign currencies into US dollars. You have to prepare and file accurate income tax returns, for 8 years, 2003 through 2010, you have to prepare and file accurate FBARs, foreign bank account reports, with the Treasury for 8 years. You have to prepare and file the so-called Title 26 offshore related information returns for foreign corporations, foreign trusts, foreign partnerships. You have to compute the correct penalty, and the penalty computation is not easy. You have to prepare the related tax. You have to pay the related tax, penalties, and interest, or at least arrange for their payment. And you have to get it all done by August 31, in just over 3 months. So a person who has, a taxpayer who has a major problem, is going to be hard put to get it all done by August 31. And what are the consequences for failing to get all of this done by August 31? According to the IRS frequently asked questions, the penalty regime, which a later panel will provide, is increased. How much? We don't know. Okay. So the IRS claims that it wants to be tough. You can ask yourself, and your clients are going to be asking themselves, does the IRS have the will, and do they have the means to enforce the tax laws? And this is an important question for all of us, because I will submit to you that a nation that lacks the will and the means to enforce the tax laws is a nation that ultimately will lose its freedom. If you can't raise money to pay for government, ultimately you won't have a government that will protect you. Let's talk about will. Based on my discussions with IRS agents, it seems fairly clear that one agent in 10 throughout the United States is working on this problem as we speak. The IRS has investigated foreign banks, including UBS, and more recently HSBC. They have reached agreement with second-tier banks in places like Switzerland and the Far East. They are relying on whistleblowers, and they are changing tax treaties. They're negotiating changes in tax treaties to permit the international exchange of information. I'd say that the government is exercising will. The last question. Even if they are exercising the will, how many people can whistleblowers target after all? Does the government have the means to credibly enforce the international tax and disclosure laws of the United States? And the answer is, very shortly, IRS will have the means to do this. IRS has studied the 15,000 people who came forward as part of the original Overseas Voluntary Disclosure Program, and the 3,000 or so people who came afterwards. All this information was put into a lead generating database located in Philadelphia. But most importantly, the IRS has decided to harness the power of the computer to efficiently, accurately, and inexpensively enforce the tax laws, because it's computers that allow the government to do this. The basic problem is that banks and brokerage companies located outside of the jurisdiction of the United States. We're not providing 1099 type information to IRS. Taxpayers realized it and they said, well, if the government isn't checking, why should I care? Well, that is about to change. Recently, Congress passed and the President signed FATCA. FATCA. The name itself seems a little bit unpleasant. The Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. It is effective as of January 1 of 2013, just over a year, year and a half. And the delay in implementation is to allow the government to negotiate deals with major foreign countries so that these foreign countries, so that the banks and brokerage companies in these countries will be able to provide this 1099 information to IRS legally. There are bank secrecy rules everywhere, of course. FATCA is something that is here to stay. As we speak, today, May 24, there is a major program in London on FATCA. It's happening today. Banks such as Bank Leumi announced months ago that they would be in compliance with FATCA. Some international banks like HSBC provide not only NR4s, which is a Canadian form of a 1099, but they also provide the 1099 to IRS as well. So my conclusion is this. Soon, there is going to be no place where people can hide. Sure, you can take your pot of gold and you can stick it in some cave in Afghanistan if you want. But if you want to be part of the system, if you or your clients want to be able to invest their money in civilized countries where there are banking laws and where there are securities laws to protect the innocent and to prevent Madoff-type swindles, there's no place to hide. All of the major banks throughout the world are going to be reporting their 1099 information. So IRS has the motive, institutional humiliation. And soon they already have demonstrated will, and they will soon have the means to enforce the international tax and disclosure laws. And when they move, I don't think that they will be particularly understanding. I will simply leave you with this conclusion and comment. Shortly after the February 8 voluntary disclosure initiative was announced, BNA put together a program, a webinar. And an IRS person was included on the webinar. And someone asked the IRS person, hey, the time deadline, the lead time, doesn't give taxpayers very much time. Do you think there'll be any flexibility? And he replied, taxpayers have had since March 23, 2009, to come into compliance. So with that in mind, I think that you realize that we're in a serious situation. I'm delighted that you're all here, and I hope that you will all learn things that you can bring back to your offices so that we can help our clients get into compliance. At this time, it is with pleasure that I ask Bill Lovett to come to the podium, unless you want to stay.
I'll sit.
Okay, Bill will sit here, and he will address the first issue. What do you think about, or what should you think about, when your client picks up the phone, calls you up, and says, I have an FBAR problem? Bill?
Thank you, Morris. Your comments remind me of a comment made by one of my clients recently, where he said, you know, the IRS can't get everyone, but every once in a while they take somebody out back and shoot them. I'm formerly of the Department of Justice Tax Division. I prosecuted criminal tax cases for a number of years. So at one point I was the guy that took the person out back and shot them. But I'm on the other side now. We have a nice PowerPoint here. I'm not going to read you the PowerPoint. If you have any questions, feel free to ask. Or if you have any questions during the presentation, feel free to ask. So the client calls you, longtime client calls you, you've been preparing their tax returns for years and says, I've been reading an awful lot about these foreign bank accounts in the newspaper. There's something I haven't told you. What do you do? Well, it depends on who you are. If you're a CPA and an attorney, you may be able to continue having that conversation with them. If you're just a CPA, you need to think about whether you should continue having that conversation with them. Under federal law, there is no accountant-client privilege. They don't recognize it. If you were to be summoned or subpoenaed by a grand jury, you couldn't assert that privilege. If you continue to have that conversation with your client, they may tell you some things that you may not want to hear. Whereas if you're an attorney and you're having that conversation with the client, that conversation is privileged. And there are ways to bring the accountant within the attorney-client privilege for the purposes of having that conversation to figure out what it is you're going to do to address the problem. Now, when clients come in and tell you or tell me or whomever that they have this problem, the first thing you got to do is you got to figure out the scope of the problem, because the initial decision point you're going to have to make is what are the facts of this case? Is this a case that could easily turn into a criminal case? In which case, you really do not want to give the IRS a whole lot of information. What happens in some instances is you file amended returns and file FBARs. Your client, unbeknownst to them, may have been on the IRS's radar screen, and you're essentially giving the IRS the rope to hang your client. And an example of this is one of the cases that came down last week in the District of Massachusetts. It's a criminal case. It's the United States v. Schiavo. Mr. Schiavo is a venture capitalist. He's a director at a Boston bank. He had an HSBC account in Bermuda. He tried to do what is known as a quiet disclosure, whereas you do not try to enter the voluntary disclosure program through the normal channels. You essentially file your FBARs and file your tax returns and try to get into compliance. Well, Mr. Schiavo was too late. He initially filed his FBARs. An IRS agent knocked on his door. A couple days later, he filed amended tax returns. And the government has just filed a criminal information against him for willfully violating the FBAR reporting requirements.
Excuse me, what is FBAR?
It's the Foreign Bank Account Report.
Okay.
And is everybody familiar with an FBAR? I guess I assume that was the case. What the FBAR is an informational return that needs to be filed with the IRS by June 30th of the following year. There are no extensions. It needs to be timely. And essentially what it does, it discloses to the IRS that you have a foreign bank account and that you're either have signatory authority over the bank account or have a beneficial interest in the bank account. It doesn't matter if the bank account is not in your name, and it really doesn't matter if it's not your money. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be assessed a tax on that money or the interest on that money is taxable to you. It's purely a disclosure requirement. And if you don't file it and it's willful, a voluntary violation of a known legal duty under the definition, it's a criminal offense. Now, does everybody get prosecuted criminally for failing to file the FBARs? No. There are thousands, probably tens of thousands of people that aren't aware of the requirement and don't file. But people like Mr. Schiavo have been prosecuted for it. And this is part of what Morris referred to as the IRS is, I guess, imposing their will. What is significant about this case is if you read the criminal information, the IRS goes to great lengths to indicate that Mr. Schiavo tried to do a silent disclosure. And in terms of how to go about disclosing this information to the IRS, if you choose to do so, there's a voluntary disclosure program. The first step is you give your client's name, social security number, and address to the IRS Criminal Investigations Division. They run the name through a database, and they determine whether the disclosure is timely. So if you're under audit, or your name's sitting on a list of clients that have UBS accounts, or you know your client's business partner has already gone to the IRS and told them all about the foreign bank account, that disclosure is not timely. You're not eligible for the voluntary disclosure program. But if you are eligible and you get into the program, you then disclose your foreign bank accounts or the unreported income to the IRS. You file amended returns. You make arrangements to pay the tax penalties and interest. And the IRS makes a promise that they will not refer the case criminally to the Criminal Investigation Division. And there are no guarantees. They may assess the case after you make the disclosure and decide they don't like what they see and decide to refer the case. So in that initial conversation you're having with your client, you need to determine what the facts are, and is there a risk of criminal prosecution? Is this a pattern of conduct that's gone on for a number of years? How much tax is owed? Is there other evidence of willfulness that may make this a criminal case? Is there concealment of assets? Is there unreported income? Those are the types of things that the IRS looks at when they determine whether they're going to refer a case criminally. Now, not every case with those facts goes to a criminal prosecution. Percentage-wise, there is a very low percentage of cases that get prosecuted criminally by the IRS in a year, and there's even a lower percentage of people that actually go to jail for this, although people do go to jail for it. But that is the initial assessment you have to make when you determine, one, do I do a voluntary disclosure? Do I talk to the IRS? Do I let the client talk to the IRS? Do I need to bring in an attorney to have the client tell this story? You know, I say in these panels that as the accountant that prepares someone's tax returns, if the IRS is going to pursue a criminal case, you're either a co-defendant or you're a star witness. And as CPAs, when the client comes in and starts to have that conversation with them, you need to think, do I still want to prepare this person's tax returns? Are there issues here that I have to think about in terms of my own professional career? Once you decide to go into the voluntary disclosure program, and by the way, let me just add, the voluntary disclosure program is not unique to foreign bank accounts. It could be for anything. It could be somebody that hasn't filed tax returns in years, somebody that has unreported income and they want to come clean. It could be anything. But it's gotten a lot of press because of the offshore voluntary disclosure initiative. Once you're in the voluntary disclosure program with respect to the offshore accounts, you then go into the voluntary disclosure initiative. And what the clients agree to, essentially, is to pay a 25% penalty on the high balance of the account over the last, I think it's now, it goes back to 2003. And as you can imagine, there are clients who you know, initially, it seems like a good idea. I don't want to be prosecuted criminally. Let's go into the voluntary disclosure program and do the initiative. And they see a tax bill for 25% of their balance of their account, and they start to think this is not such a good idea. And you also have to pick up any unreported tax, unreported income, pay the tax. You have to pay an accuracy-related penalty. So the tax bills could be substantial. So once you're in the program, you need to make decisions. Do I stay in the initiative? Do I want to contest the penalty and seek a lower penalty? And one of the other speakers will talk about the penalty structure. But those are all issues that are in the mix. If you think there's a criminal problem here, if the client comes in and says, you know, I've got this Swiss bank account overseas, I didn't tell you about my business, you know, selling cocaine, and I've skimmed it all, I've laundered everything overseas, stop the conversation and tell them you need to go see a lawyer. Under the current voluntary disclosure initiative, there's an August 31st, 2011 deadline. I think Morris alluded to that. And that's sort of a hard deadline the IRS has put in place. You have to have all the FBARs filed and all the amended returns filed by that date. And that presents some challenges, given that you know, some of these foreign bank account records are difficult to obtain. You may have issues with tax returns filed in foreign jurisdictions and trying to figure out exactly what needs to be on the amended return. How the IRS will deal with that hard and fast deadline, it's really anybody's guess. I, you know, my sense is that once you're in the initiative and you're making a good faith effort to meet the deadline, I'm not sure they're going to throw you out of the initiative because all the I's aren't dotted and T's are crossed by August 31st. There'll probably be yet another initiative down the road, and that will be more onerous than the second one, and the second one is more onerous than the first one. So I think the IRS will continue to encourage people to come forward. They will continue to bring criminal cases where they think it's appropriate, and you know, it really, there's really no roadmap for how to handle this. Each case is different. Each client's risk tolerance is different. There are some cases that the client, frankly, would be better off litigating with the IRS. Say, I don't think this is willful, and the amount of tax due here is de minimis. I didn't file the FBAR return, but I don't want to pay 25% of my account balance over to the IRS. And frankly, in the right case, the client should litigate it and hold the IRS's feet to the fire. If you go into the voluntary disclosure initiative, you're waiving all your appellate rights. There's no right to litigate those issues. You can't ask for a lower penalty except under narrowly defined circumstances. And there's really no flexibility on the part of the IRS agents handling these cases to give you a lesser penalty. So sometimes the better course may be just to opt out or do a silent disclosure where you get your client into compliance, and if the IRS shows up, you've got a good explanation as to why they weren't in compliance in the first instance. Let me just talk a little bit about the voluntary disclosure procedures. There's actually two voluntary disclosure programs. One's with the IRS. And as I mentioned, there's no guarantees. If you go in and you do the voluntary disclosure, and the IRS doesn't like what you have to say, they may kick you out of the program and refer the case for criminal prosecution. And the language of the program says they may not refer you, so no guarantees. The second program is the Department of Justice program, and the Department of Justice doesn't make any promises either. They say that the voluntary disclosure is one factor the Department of Justice will consider in determining whether to go forward with a criminal prosecution. Now, as a practical matter, if the IRS doesn't send the case to the Department of Justice, the Department of Justice is not going to prosecute the taxpayer. But a taxpayer needs to understand that when they go into this program, all the cards have to be on the table. They can't tell half a story. You can't go in there and lie to the IRS, because if that happens, you're likely going to be thrown out of the program, and your chances of being prosecuted criminally increases exponentially. The IRS doesn't like when you lie to them. So I don't know if you have anything to add, Morris.
Not really. Just perhaps one quick issue. Every now and then, a professional may be working with a client that they've known for many years, and the professional realizes that the client is basically a decent person. What should you think about if the client says, gee, can you help me out of this? And what the client really is looking for is some way to just hide the situation. What do you do then?
Well, under no circumstances can you file or prepare a false return for a client. Because what inevitably happens is it gets you into trouble. There is a concept in criminal tax law called the good faith reliance on counsel defense, which is a complete defense to a tax evasion charge. So if the client says, I disclosed the foreign bank account to my tax preparer, and he told me I didn't need to report it. Well, that's good for the client. It's not so good for you. So these are tough conversations you're going to have with some longtime clients, people that you may know pretty well, but under no circumstances can you tell them or advise them or assist them in filing a tax return that's false, that doesn't disclose foreign bank accounts that you know about. It's better not to file the return and pay the tax that's owed and file a return that's later going to come back to bite you and or the client. And I'm seeing a lot of this where people think they're, you know, they may have had a UBS account. They're really unsure whether their name is on a list or what's been turned over to the IRS. You cannot file an account, a return, if you think that the IRS has that information, because you're just asking for it.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to hold your question, and we're just about out of time for Bill. I'd just like to make one other comment, and that is that if you're a CPA and your client tells you that there's a that they haven't filed their FBAR, according to the frequently asked questions that the IRS has provided us with, it says that you cannot simply say, well, I will prepare appropriate income tax returns in the future and we'll forget about the past. At least according to the IRS, that is a circular 230 problem. So basically, the government is asking the accounting profession to, and or the tax preparer profession to act as their policeman. It's a serious problem, but you should be aware of that. With that, I would like to, do you have any last questions?
Well, I have a question for Ellen.
I'd like to turn the
Jonathan has a question.
Yes.
I don't like to disagree with you or Bill, but
sure. Louder, please.
Yeah. As far as the scope goes, you have about 5 million Americans living overseas, and only about 450,000 tax returns being filed from overseas. You also have tens of millions of first-generation immigrants to the country. The scope of the issue is much, much larger than the tens of thousands of people not reporting. When I talk to groups of people who are not from this country or Americans overseas, generally speaking, the knowledge still at the CPA level, not necessarily the taxpayer level, is still pretty small. Mm-hmm. And so I agree with what you said, the IRS is getting very aggressive on this, but they have still done a very, very poor job of communicating with both the professional and individual taxpayer community. So this issue, for those of you who are experienced working with international people. You're going to have years and years of business to come from this. If you're not experienced working with international people, you could be getting yourself in a lot more trouble than you think, because I see plenty of people saying taking these FBAR and foreign tax issues rather lightly. So I'd like Bill's comment on that.
Yeah, I agree. This is a huge problem for a lot of people, and the IRS has not provided clear guidance on how to deal with this. What they've done is thrown out the threat of criminal prosecution. The assumption is that if you have a foreign bank account and it's not reported, that you somehow acted willfully and that you're trying to evade your taxes, which is not always the case. And in fact, it's probably not the case for most people. But this is the approach the IRS has taken. I think they feel that by putting this out there, that they'll get more people to come into compliance. And frankly, I think it's having the opposite effect. It's driving more people underground, overseas.
Until FATCA catches up with them.
Well, yeah, I mean, people are renouncing their citizenship. It's a real mess, to be honest with you.
That's a perfect segue about people renouncing their citizenship, because we have an immigration attorney with us, Ellen Keith. Keith, is it?
Keith,
I apologize.
Okay.
Who is going to be talking a little bit about that. That's called expatriation, am I right?
That's correct.
Ellen?
Yes.
I just want to let everyone know how to find the materials in the folder. Bill's talk was on the first thing after the evaluations. The Schiava case he referenced was on page 4. And Ellen's presentation, her written comments, are on page 25 of the book that begins, No Factual Determination, page 25. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome. My name is Ellen Keefe, and it's a pleasure to see you all here today. I practice immigration law. I do not practice tax law, but tax law is crucial to all of our clients. Being international clients and coming from all over the world, if they're working here, visiting here, staying here. I know you have the 183-day rule, and what we advise all our immigration clients to do is to go seek out experienced international tax attorneys, because the consequences can be dire. So as professionals, that's what we do in terms of the tax part. And what I'd like to do today is just give you a little brief introduction about immigration law, what some of the categories are, and how some people can be subject and penalized based on tax consequences. So I'm just going to give first a brief overview. There's 5 major categories in immigration law. The first is what we call non-immigrant visas. Those are the types of visas where people have non-immigrant intent, meaning they're coming here to visit, for example, on a B1, B2. Business visitors come in, they sign contracts, they have meetings, they meet with attorneys, they meet with their accountants. They come in knowing that they are required to leave after a certain period of time. So those are our non-immigrant status visas. F1 students also fall under that category, non-immigrant. However, when people are here on non-immigrant status, some people work here, or some people have issues in terms of addressing accounting and tax issues that seek whether they're here 183 days or not, or whether they're an overstay. So that's one category that has potential tax issues. Another is what we call immigrant visas, and those are the green card holders. For example, on a business, we have H-1Bs, which are something you may or may not have heard about, but those are professionals who come here and seek to work in the United States and get sponsored by an employer. Those are generally under the non-immigrant intent category. They come here, they get up to 3 years, can renew another 3 years, so it's a 6-year visa. The difference with H-1Bs is that they can get sponsored from their employer to become green card holders. You may have heard Microsoft, in fact, had moved their headquarters to Vancouver several years ago because they were trying to employ H-1B visa holders, international people, to come and work for their company. But the government limits the H-1Bs at $65,000 if you have an undergraduate degree and $20,000 if you have a graduate degree. Up until about 2 years ago, so 3 years ago, 4 years ago, these H-1B limits or caps, $65,000 for undergraduate, $20,000 for graduate, were literally used up the first day we had a lottery system. Because of the turn in the economy over the past couple of years, these H-1B visas have been available for a much longer period of time. April 1st is the date when you could initially put in your application for an October 1st start date. Last year, the April 1st date did not fill up in terms of visas until the first week in February. So we have a lot of H-1Bs available now because people are hiring U.S. citizens. They're not hiring necessarily international workers. And it is a difficulty on both parts because we have global immigration, global economy. We do want to bring in people from all over the world to help and assist with corporations. So the H-1B category falls under non-immigrant but can be an immigrant visa when the employer can sponsor this H-1B visa holder. If there's nobody in our economy who's able, qualified, willing, and available to work in this particular job. So it's a very difficult test to meet. Now that our labor force, we have a lot of unemployed people. So a lot of our H-1B workers are not being sponsored for green cards as they used to be. I'm going to talk also the H-1B green card holders, if they do get sponsored, obviously have all kinds of tax issues that they must address. They're working here, they're under a non-immigrant visa, they may have property, estates in other places. They're here for over 183 days, that you have your 183-day rule. And mostly, they're not aware of the worldwide tax that's involved. So we have to really educate people who are here on immigrant, non-immigrant visas as to what the tax consequences are. We also have what's called an asylee refugee group. Citizens, people who become citizens, and undocumented immigrants. So those are essentially the five categories: non-immigrant visas, immigrant visas, asylees, citizens, and undocumented. I'm going to address the green card piece for a little bit because that has a lot of tax consequences in terms of issues that they face when they're green card holders. There's essentially four ways to become a green card holder. You could be a family-based sponsor. For example, a U.S. citizen marries somebody who is not a U.S. citizen, and they can get what's called an adjustment of status. They can come here as a visitor, as a B1, B2, which is non-immigrant intent, as long as they didn't inform their intention to get married when they crossed the border but came here, fell in love, they can adjust their status. In fact, they can even adjust their status if they're an overstay. Family adjustment of status is one of the most desirable ways of getting a green card. Hence the very high fraud that goes along with it. So the government very heavily scrutinizes whether somebody came here to get married to a U.S. citizen to get the adjustment of status and to gain the benefits. If somebody comes here on a fraud to get married, then they are precluded from ever entering the United States. So we have what's called a conditional residency card. So meaning if you come into the United States, you come in, for example, as an H-1B worker, you come in to visit as a B-1, B-2, or a student, and you get married within the first 2 years, the government doesn't outrightly give you a green card. They give you what's called a conditional green card. And 1 year and 9 months after they give you that card, you have to fill out an application, an I-751, and the government revisits. They look at your, are you living together? They look at you, whether you really got married. They look if you have bank accounts together. They look at whether you are getting mail that has both your name. So they really scrutinize to see whether or not this was a viable marriage. Now, you don't need to stay married because we can't force marriage, but again, it goes back to the intent at the time. Did you intend to get married because of love, or did you intend to get married because you want to get that nice green card at the end of the day? So there's that look back period. In fact, it can be a look back period forever. They can end up getting naturalized, which is an N-400. And if they found out that fraud was committed at the time, they can actually withdraw or take away their citizenship. I'd like to also approach the lawful permanent residents from the side of business. So we talked about the H-1B who can sponsor somebody, which is called a perm, if there's nobody else who's willing, able, and qualified for the position, and there's also a salary regard as well, that the company or employer can sponsor somebody for a green card. What happens in immigration a lot of times, we have what's called executives or other workers that have affiliates or subsidiaries in other countries. So somebody comes here as a lawful permanent resident, there's a residency requirement, meaning that they must spend half the time, 6 months out of the year, and it must be that this is their actual residence. What's happened in the past, people will get their lawful permanent resident, they'll go back home, and they'll just touch base here for a short period of time, and then go back home. The government has been really cracking down on cases where they find lawful permanent residents do not really have their residency here. And some of the factors that they look at is their home here, where are their kids, where's their dog, and one of the biggest factors is whether they declared themselves for tax purposes a resident here in the U.S. If they checked off on the form that they're a non-resident of the U.S. for tax purposes, that is one of the major factors where their lawful permanent residence can be taken away from them. So when they're filling out their tax form as a lawful permanent resident, they must be sure that they are an actual resident here, and that when they complete the tax form, that they are declaring themselves as a resident for tax purposes. A lawful permanent resident, sorry.
Can I ask a quick question? Suppose if a U.S. citizen goes abroad for a year or more, they can get an exclusion off of their United States income taxes as a U.S. citizen who's working abroad. Can a green card holder do that?
I can't address any of the tax part. Those I leave to the expert. So even if I could guess at the answer, I'm extremely careful not to give any tax advice, but to heed the warnings. So that's an excellent question, and I think that that's something that should be addressed. In terms of going abroad, so if you're a lawful permanent resident, again, I mentioned that you need to have the required residence here. Now, there's exceptions. You can get what's called a re-entry permit. For example, a CEO who has a lawful permanent residency here in the U.S. has their headquarter company in Canada. The CEO is requested or required to go to Canada for 2 years to help with the subsidiary executive functions. What they can do and what they should do is apply for what's called a re-entry permit. And what that means is a re-entry permit grants them the permission, in essence, to go abroad for 2 years to work in the company and not be at risk, potentially, you're always at risk, potentially, of losing your lawful permanent resident status. You can get up to 2 years. Sometimes you can reapply. You don't get an extension or a renewal, but reapply for another 2 years if that's the case. But the litmus test on that is, again, on their tax forms, they need to file that they are, in fact, a resident of the U.S. as a lawful permanent resident, that they declare all of their taxes, and that their true residence is here in the U.S. So, for example, do they still have a home here? Are they filing taxes here? Where is their family? Now, of course, if you're going abroad for 2 years, you may not have a home that maybe you're renting your home. But again, these are very fact-specific cases that need to be looked at. But if you fill your tax return form out and say that you're filing as a non-resident of the U.S., it's highly likely that you can get denied and that you will get scrutinized. A big consequence for people who have their lawful permanent resident status is if they have tax or property or trusts in other countries. They're always confused about the decision. Should I become a citizen? How will that help me? If I'm visiting as a visitor or an intercompany transferee, can I only stay for 183 days, and am I going to be subject to the tax consequences? So these are things that we refer out to get addressed, and they're important issues when people come in as business visitors, whether they're coming in too often and they're getting into the 183-day rule and they're trying to now shift that people don't come into the United States as often under that category. For lawful permanent resident, again, just to revisit this reentry permit, again, if you've been continuing to reapply, after a 5-year period of time, they'll only give you a reentry permit for a 1-year period of time, and then they'll scrutinize the case to make sure that you're really, your intent really is to come back to the U.S. So lawful permanent residents are highly scrutinized. Again, do they really have a residency here? And sorry.
Can I ask a quick question? In our practice, we've found that a lot of people from outside of the United States have come forward and have asked us for assistance. We have had people who are engineers from India or business people from Canada or whatever. People, various types of people, and they have different types of visas. And sometimes they have green cards, sometimes they don't have green cards. What kind of trouble can these people get into as non-citizens who are here for over 183 days and are therefore subject to all the laws of all the tax laws, rather, of the United States? What happens if they don't follow through on these tax laws?
Well, in terms of immigration, they can get deported. So they have to follow the tax laws. That's under high scrutiny for deportation. So as a lawful permanent resident, if they're not filing their taxes, or even as a non-immigrant, that can be an issue for deportation.
Are they subject to deportation even if there's no criminal case?
That's correct. So the immigration laws are very different than, for example, if you look at somebody who's a citizen versus someone who is not a citizen under immigration, the laws are completely different. If you take we were discussing criminal issues earlier, something that might be considered a misdemeanor for somebody who's a citizen could be aggravated, considered an aggravated felony if they're a lawful permanent resident. So there's reporting requirements. For example, if they move as a lawful permanent resident, you're required within 10 days to report your new address. You have, obviously, your tax obligations, crimes involving moral turpitude, so crimes where there's family members involved, and other criminal issues that are considered, you know, at a lower level here, are considered at a much higher standard and subject to deportation. So it's treated a little bit differently. Did you?
Yeah. Morris, I wanted to answer your first question.
I'm just going to ask if you can just hold off for 1 minute. I'm just going to continue on this vein, and then perhaps we can go back and address. Thank you. I'd like to also... immigration, there's a lot of different categories. Laws change literally daily, and it's very important that each case fact by fact be analyzed. There's no case that's the same, and it's usually in immigration what you don't know that you need to be afraid of instead of what you do know. And in any case, for example, if somebody comes here, we were talking about an H-1B visa, but they're married, we might do an adjustment of status marriage-based rather than go family, rather than go through business. And I'm just going to also address quickly that based on marriage, after 3 years of the marriage, you could naturalize. Based on a green card through business, you can naturalize after 5 years. And I know that's also very important for tax issues. But I'm going to just move quickly to the expatriation and renunciation of citizenship. Oftentimes people will say, well, geez, you know, I don't need to be here in the U.S. I owe a lot of taxes, and if I leave or expatriate, am I still obligated to pay taxes? Well, the answer is of course, and in fact, under the statutes, it's considered a criminal offense not to pay taxes if for the purpose of expatriation. So if you want to avoid tax by expatriating for that sole purpose, that's considered a crime. Under immigration. If somebody wants to renounce their citizenship, it must be voluntary under study conditions, voluntary, and they have to have the intent to, and they fill out a form which is called the I-407, which is then usually at a consulate outside the country. So somebody goes, they want to renounce it, they also need to have the intent. So there's some case law where somebody came in and they said they want to renounce their citizenship, but came that they still wanted to have the benefits of traveling and being able to travel. What they didn't realize was that, in fact, they shouldn't have really renounced their citizenship because they didn't realize that they were giving up some of the benefits. And so because they didn't have the intent, in fact, they got reinstated. But for the most part, it's very, very difficult to reinstate your citizenship. The same thing with a lawful permanent residency. Once you don't meet the requirements anymore, there are several ways lawful permanent residency can get taken away from you. When you come in at the border, they can take your card, and then you have to appear before an immigration judge to... And in fact, the burden is on the government to prove that you are no longer meeting the categories. But under expatriation, another thing I'd like to mention is that it's very important that a international tax attorney talk to them about what kinds of conditions and what kinds of tax consequences they're required to pay. And if this doesn't get settled, obviously, the IRS or the will go after them, but it will also affect their ability to immigrate should they desire in the future. So that's something to also, in terms of renouncing citizenship, an adult cannot renounce a child's citizenship who's under the age of 18. And so the child would have to have the understanding and intent to renounce. If they did and they did not understand, they have up to 6 months after the age of 18 to go back and say that they did not have the intent. So there's a lot more to cover. I could go on for days, but I think my time is up. But just in terms of, if I could leave last words, is that anybody who's here under immigration laws, across the board, there are accounting tax issues that must be addressed, and it's important that they seek the professional international tax assistance that's required. So thank you.
Can I just ask one quick question?
Sure.
I had a potential client call recently, a couple weeks ago, and he asked what impact, if any, will his participation in OVDI have on his immigration status as a green card holder, permanent resident. And I was just wondering if there's any consequences on immigration, if there's a, it's not a criminal action, but it's, could be considered a, civil investigation or, an audit. And I was just wondering if something like that could jeopardize a green card holder.
Yeah, all tax issues can potentially jeopardize a green card holder or anybody who's here under either non-immigrant or immigrant status.
Although, it's unclear whether the IRS would turn that information over. 6103 prohibits the disclosure of tax and tax return information and limits it to specific circumstances. So, That's a consideration as well.
However, just to remind you again that immigration is treated differently, so that it may not be considered, but have there could be potential consequences.
I think that the takeaway here is that if your client has an immigrant status and the issue is serious, an immigration attorney should definitely be consulted. Don't go it alone. We're running a little bit behind, so I'm going to move a little bit quickly through my part of the panel. Basically, once the client has come in, the client really wants to know, what do I do? There are five possible answers. One is expatriation. That's probably not going to happen. The second is do nothing, and I don't recommend that. The other three are quiet disclosure, regular disclosure, and participation in this 2011 OVDI. The quiet disclosure, of course, is you just file back tax returns and hope for the best and hope that you don't get indicted, as Bill Lovett suggested. The regular disclosure is you just come forward, but not necessarily through the OVDI, and then there's the OVDI. In order to reach a conclusion, you have to know a lot. The first thing you have to know is how much is owed. You have to prepare tax returns. How much is owed? What are the penalties? What is the interest? What income was not disclosed? The second, is there a possibility of criminal prosecution? It's going to make a difference. Is there willfulness? Was there concealment of assets or whatever, so that we can say that the client did not, that the client willfully chose not to disclose? And second and finally, have to figure out what the penalty structure is. And the next two panels are going to deal with these issues. Panel number two is going to talk about some of the issues that are necessary for preparation of correct income tax returns and FBARs. Panel number three is going to deal with the penalty structure under OVDI. Only after we understand these items can we really make a final conclusion. What do we do? The client wants to know it at the first meeting. The truth is, we cannot really provide that information until we've gone through the process. And so that's what the fourth panel is going to be discussing. The fourth panel is going to be dealing with a number of permutations and combinations of facts. We would invite you folks to present your own questions in a outline form as well. And the fourth panel will try to address those issues and try to just pull it all together and tie it all together. And so at this point, I'd like to ask the folks from panel number two to come forward. And Norman LeBlanc, Greg is already at the end. And we'll get started.